This explanation rests on illustrating a few interesting properties of how proof of work is used in the blockchain that are not immediately obvious and sometimes are rather counterintuitive. For example, how participants collectively solve a problem without ever communicating. Having understood each of these properties, one should conclude that proof of work is primarily a mechanism which accomplishes a distributed and decentralized system of timing. In other words, a clock. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I'm Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What's up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I'm Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else, you know, and we've got a great read today. If y'all listened to episode 188 of Tales from the Crypt with Chris Bendixson, he mentioned a piece that I realized I had never read on the show, and I had a couple of people recommend it to me or ask me if I had it on the show, and I didn't. And I figured this was a really good one to have in audio, and particularly to talk about, because it's just such a fascinating idea. But it's titled, it's on Grisha.org, so Grisha.org, and it's titled, Blockchain Proof of Work is a Decentralized Clock. And it was posted about 2 years ago, and some changes, January 2018. But without wasting any more time, let's go ahead and jump in to Blockchain Proof of Work is a Decentralized Clock. This is an explanation of the key function on proof of work in the Bitcoin blockchain. It focuses on the one feature of proof of work that is essential and shows that other features often talked about, such as security, are secondary side effects, useful but not essential. This explanation rests on illustrating a few interesting properties of how proof of work is used in the blockchain that are not immediately obvious and sometimes are rather counterintuitive. For example, how participants collectively solve a problem without ever communicating. Having understood each of these properties, one should conclude that proof of work is primarily a mechanism which accomplishes a distributed and decentralized system of timing. In other words, a clock. Note that this write-up isn't about proof of work per se. It explains how the blockchain takes advantage of it. If you do not know anything about proof of work, then this link might be a good start. The Decentralized Ledger Time Ordering Problem. Before describing the solution, let us focus on the problem. Much of the literature around proof of work is so confusing because it attempts to explain the solution without first identifying the problem. Any ledger absolutely needs order. One cannot spend money that has not been received, nor can one spend money that is already spent. Blockchain transactions, or blocks containing them, must be ordered unambiguously and without the need for a trusted third party. Even if the blockchain was not a ledger, but just data like a log of some sort, for every node to have an identical copy of the blockchain, order is required. A blockchain in a different order is a different blockchain. But if transactions are generated by anonymous participants all over the world, and no central party is responsible for organizing the list, how can it be done? For example, transactions, or blocks, could include timestamps, but how could these timestamps be trusted? Time is but a human concept, and any source of it, such as an atomic clock, is a trusted third party, which on top of everything is slightly wrong most of the time due to network delays as well as the effects of relativity. Even time dilation between someone in an airplane versus the ground, though minute, is sufficient to make ordering impossible. Paradoxically, relying on a timestamp to determine event order is not possible in a decentralized, geographically dispersed system. The quote, time that we are interested in is not the year, month, day, etc. that we're used to. What we need is a mechanism by which we can verify that one event took place before another, or perhaps concurrently. First, though, for the notions of before and after to be applicable, a point in time needs to be established. Establishing a point in time may seem theoretically impossible at first, because there is no technology accurate enough to measure a Planck. But as you'll see, Bitcoin works around this by creating its own notion of time, where precise points in time are in fact impossible. The problem is well described in Leslie Lamport's 1978 paper, Time, Clocks, and the Ordering of Events in a Distributed System, which doesn't actually provide a comprehensive solution other than properly synchronized physical clocks. In 1982, Lamport also described the Byzantine generals problem, and Satoshi, in one of his first emails, explains how proof of work is a solution, though the Bitcoin paper states, quote, "To implement a distributed timestamp server on a peer-to-peer basis, we will need to use a proof-of-work system," end quote, suggesting that it primarily solves the issue of timestamping. Timing is the root problem. It must be stressed that the impossibility of associating events with points in time in distributed systems was the unsolved problem that precluded a decentralized ledger from ever being possible until Satoshi Nakamoto invented a solution. There are many other technical details that play into the blockchain, but timing is fundamental and paramount. Without timing, there is no blockchain. Proof of Work Recap. Very briefly, the Bitcoin proof of work is a value whose SHA-2 hash conforms to a certain requirement, which makes such a value difficult to find. The difficulty is established by requiring that the hash is less than a specific number. The smaller the number, the more rare the input value, and the higher the difficulty of finding it. It is called, quote, proof of work because it is known that a value with such a hash is extremely rare, which means that finding such a value requires a lot of trial and error. In other words, work. Work, in turn, implies time. By varying the requirement, we can vary the difficulty, and thus the probability, of such a hash being found. The Bitcoin difficulty adjusts dynamically so that a proper hash is found, on average, once every 10 minutes. Nothing happens between blocks. The state of the chain is reflected by its blocks, and each new block produces a new state. The blockchain state moves forward one block at a time, and the average 10 minutes of a block is the smallest measure of blockchain time. SHA is memoryless and progress-free. The secure hash algorithm is what is known in statistics and probability as memoryless. This is a property that is particularly counterintuitive for us humans. The best example of memorylessness is a coin toss. If a coin comes up heads 10 times in a row, does it mean that the next toss is more likely to be tails? Our intuition says yes, but in reality, each toss has a 50-50 chance of either outcome, regardless of what happened immediately prior. Memorylessness is required for the problem to be progress-free. Progress-free means that as miners try to solve blocks iterating over nonces, each attempt is a standalone event, and the probability of finding a solution is constant at each attempt, regardless of how much work has been done in the past. In other words, at each attempt, the participant is not getting any, quote, closer to a solution, or is making no progress. And a miner who's been looking for a solution for a year isn't more likely to solve a block at the next attempt than a miner who started a second ago. The probability of finding the solution given a specific difficulty in a given period of time is therefore determined solely by the speed at which all participants can iterate through the hashes. Not the prior history, not the data, just the hash rate. The hash rate, in turn, is a function of the number of participants and the speed of the equipment used to calculate the hash. Note: though strictly speaking, SHA is not progress-free because there is a finite number of hashes, the range of a 256-bit integer is so vast that it is practically progress-free. The SHA input is irrelevant. In the Bitcoin blockchain, the input is a block header. But if we just fed it random values, the probability of finding a conforming hash will still be the same, regardless of whether the input is a valid block header or bytes from dev/random. It is going to take 10 minutes on average to find a solution. Of course, if you find a conforming hash but your input wasn't a valid block, such a solution cannot be added to the blockchain, but it is still proof of work, albeit useless. The difficulty is intergalactic. Curiously, the difficulty is universal, meaning it spans the entire universe. We could have miners on Mars helping out. They do not need to know or communicate with the Earth miners. The problem would still be solved every 10 minutes. Okay, they'll need to somehow tell the Earth people that they solved it if they do, or else we'll never know about it. Remarkably, the distant participants are communicating without actually communicating, because they are collectively solving the same statistical problem, and yet they're not even aware of each other's existence. This universal property, while at first seemingly magical, is actually easy to explain. I used the term universal because it describes it well in one word, but really it means, quote, known by every participant. The input to SHA-256 can be thought of as an integer between 0 and 2 to the 256th power. Because the output is 32 bytes, in other words, also between 0 and 2 to the 256th, anything larger guarantees a collision, in other words, it becomes redundant. Even though it is extremely large, exponentially larger than the number of atoms in the perceivable universe, it is a set of numbers that is known by every participant, and the participants can only pick from this set. If the input set is universally known, the function SHA-256 is universally known, as well as the difficulty requirement is universally known, then the probability of finding a solution is also indeed universal. Trying a SHA makes you a participant. If the stated problem is to find a conforming hash, all you have to do is try it once, and bingo, you've affected the global hash rate. And for that one attempt, you were a participant helping others solve the problem. You did not need to tell others that you did it, unless you actually found a solution. Others didn't need to know about it, but your attempt did affect the outcome, for the whole universe, no less. If the above still seems suspicious, a good analogy might be the problem of finding large prime numbers. Finding the largest prime number is hard, and once one is found, it becomes discovered or known. There is an infinite number of prime numbers, but only one instance of each number in the universe. Therefore, whoever attempts to find the largest prime number is working on the same problem, not a separate instance of it. You do not need to tell anyone you decided to look for the largest prime. You only need to announce when you find one. If no one ever looks for the largest prime, then it is never going to be found. Thus, participation, in other words, an attempt to find one, even if it's in total secrecy, still affects the outcome, as long as the final discovery, if found at all, is publicized. Taking advantage of this mind-bogglingly probabilistic phenomenon, whereby any participation affects the outcome, even if it's in complete secrecy and without success, is what makes Satoshi's invention so remarkably brilliant. It is noteworthy that since SHA is progress-free, each attempt could be thought of as a participant joining the effort and immediately leaving. Thus, miners join and leave quintillions of times per second. The participation is revealed in statistics. The magical secret participation property also works in reverse. The global hash rate listed on many sites is known not because every miner registered at some miner's registration office where they report their hash rate periodically. No such thing exists. The hash rate is known because for a solution of a specific difficulty to be found in 10 minutes, on average, this many attempts, approximately 10 to the 21, as of this writing, had to have been made by someone somewhere. We do not know who these participants are. They never announced that they are working. Those who did not find a solution, which is practically all of them, never told anyone they were working. Their location could have been anywhere in the universe, and yet we know with absolute certainty that they exist, simply because the problem continues to be solved. Work is a clock. And there is the crux of it. The difficulty in finding a conforming hash acts as a clock. A universal clock, if you will, because there is only one such clock in the universe, and thus there is nothing to sync, and anyone can, quote, look at it. It doesn't matter that this clock is imprecise. What matters is that it is the same clock for everyone, and that the state of the chain can be tied unambiguously to the ticks of this clock. This clock is operated by the multi-exahash rate of an unknown number of collective participants spread across the planet, completely independent of one another. Last piece of the puzzle. The solution must be the hash of a block, the block header, to be precise. As we mentioned, the input doesn't matter, but if it is an actual block, then whenever a solution is found, it happened at the tick of our proof-of-work clock. Not before, not after, but exactly at. We know this unambiguously because the block was part of that mechanism. To put it another way, if blocks weren't the input to the SHA-256 function, we'd still have a distributed clock, but we couldn't tie blocks to the ticks of this clock. Using blocks as the input addresses this issue. Noteworthy is that our proof-of-work clock only provides us with ticks. There is no way to tell order from the ticks. This is what the hash chain is for. What about the distributed consensus? Consensus means agreement. What all participants have no choice but to agree on is that the clock has ticked. Also, that everyone knows the tick and the data attached to it. And this, in fact, does solve the Byzantine General's problem, as Satoshi explained in an email referenced earlier. There is a separate consensus in a rare but common case of two consecutive ticks being associated with conflicting blocks. The conflict is resolved by what block will be associated with the next tick, rendering one of the disputed blocks orphan. How the chain will continue is a matter of chance, and so this too could probably be indirectly attributed to the proof-of-work clock. And that is it. This is what proof-of-work does for the blockchain. It is not a lottery where miners win the right to solve a block, nor is it some peculiar conversion of real energy into a valuable concept. Those are all red herrings. For example, the lottery and the miner's reward aspect is what encourages miners to participate, but it isn't what makes the blockchain possible. Block hashes form a chain, but again, that has nothing to do with proof of work. It cryptographically reinforces recording of the block ordering. The hash chain also makes the previous ticks, quote, more certain, less deniable, or simply more secure. And proof of work is also the mechanism by which blocks become effectively immutable. And that's a nice side effect, which makes segregated witness possible, but it could just as well be done by preserving the signatures or witness. So this too is secondary. Conclusion. The Bitcoin blockchain proof of work is simply a distributed, decentralized clock. If you understand this explanation, then you should have a much better grasp of how proof-of-work compares to proof-of-stake. And it should be apparent that the two are not comparable. Proof-of-stake is about randomly distributed authority, while proof of work is a clock. In the context of the blockchain, proof of work is probably a misnomer. The term is a legacy from the Hashcash project, where it indeed served to prove work. In the blockchain, it is primarily about verifiably taking time. When one sees a hash that satisfies the difficulty, one knows it must have taken time. The method by which the delay is accomplished is work, but the hash is primarily interesting because it is a proof of time. The fact that proof of work is all about time rather than work also suggests that there may be other similar statistical challenges that are time-consuming but require less energy. It may also mean that the Bitcoin hash rate is excessive, and that the Bitcoin clock we described above could operate as reliably on a fraction of the hash rate, but it is the incentive structure that drives up the energy consumption. Figuring out a way to pace ticks with less work is a trillion-dollar problem. If you find one, please do let me know. And that will close out Blockchain Proof of Work is a Decentralized Clock. Again, this is on Grisha.org. Now, this is just a really, really cool way to look at it because it's funny how much we focus on what is essentially a side effect, but the entire purpose of the blockchain is a system of ordering. And I love how, like, you know, we know this from Satoshi. This is why, again, we've talked about this numerous times recently on the show, is that it's not really about telling time in the sense of human time, but telling time in a sense of what came before or after another thing in the context of Bitcoin. And that's why I love the concept, love the term time chain. And that's why I believe Satoshi referred to it as a time chain. As he says in that quote, it's a way to create a distributed timestamping server. Now, before we get into it, we don't have a sponsor for today's episode. But again, if you would like to support this show, you can always become a patron at patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy. And, you know, share this out with everybody you know. That's always a great, easy, cheap way to support the podcast, is to make sure it reaches other people in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space who may not know about this show and all the awesome reads and guys' takes that we cover, as well as the interviews. You know, we do all of it on this show. But if you have a project or service that you think would be great for the audience, hit me up. You can either DM me on Twitter, I am at the crypto economy, or hit me up at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com by email, and I would love to chat with you about opportunity to, you know, talk about the project on the show. But let's go ahead and get into Guy's take on this read. By the way, a huge thanks to Tales from the Crypt, Marty and Chris Bendixson for mentioning this and talking about this, because I had kind of forgotten about it. This is another one of those ones that had landed on my list at some point years ago and just never got back to it. So I still wonder, my list, as I literally have thousands of articles and stuff at this point, and so many of them I have read and meant to get to. It's a hell of an organizational problem, believe it or not. So thanks to everybody who mentioned it to me and pointed me towards that episode. And of course, them for bringing it up, because this is such a fascinating concept. And it's amazing how many of the side effects of this thing that we focus on without realizing or without really kind of putting our finger on the ultimate purpose of proof of work. Now, I think some of those side effects are almost equally important in the context of an adversarial environment. Because it's not simply about telling time, but telling time in the face of someone who might want to manipulate that time. And that's where I think the energy, we'll go into kind of that last paragraph about could we do it in a way that didn't use so much energy, which I'd agree is a trillion-dollar problem, because I think Bitcoin solves a multi-trillion dollar problem in and of itself, and therefore is destined to be worth that much and more so. But If we could find a non-energy intensive way to actually prevent the manipulation and the corruption of that decentralized clock or that decentralized time-telling system, that would be great. But right now, I think it only makes practical sense from the context of a cost that the incentive structure defends the system with an enormous cost, which means it needs to fund an enormous reward, essentially. But we'll get back to that in just a second. But right at the beginning of this piece, it talks about how, like, the one essential function, the other features of proof of work specifically are, as we say, side effects. The security is a side effect. It's useful, but it's not essential for the ultimate function that proof of work performs. But one of the most interesting properties that is really, really well explained in this is that participants are collectively solving a problem despite the fact that they are never communicating, and that anybody who participates, every person who participates, even with a single hash, is actually working towards solving the problem. They change the nature of the outcome and the speed of finding the solution, because the stipulations of the problem, because the parameters of the problem, and the rules by which the problem must be solved, because those things are universal, then actually attempting to solve the problem is universal as well. The entire thing becomes something that everyone can collectively work on without ever having to actually communicate with each other that they are actually working on it. It is literally coordination without any communication. And by having people collectively work on this problem whose parameters are constantly adjusted, it's proof of work becomes a way to create a decentralized system of timing. And like the quote, like I kind of mentioned and we've talked about recently on the show, but there's a quote in this that I just like to reiterate, quote, that the time we are interested in is not the year, month, day, etc. that we are used to. What we need is a mechanism by which we can verify that one event took place before another, or perhaps concurrently. And that is the nature of time. It's telling time with relation to itself, not time with relation to anything, quote-unquote, human, like with anything in the physical world. And it's actually touched on in this one as well. I didn't save the quote. But somewhere in this, it talks about how the blockchain itself does not prove anything about external space, the external world, like the actual reality that it's being developed in, I guess you could say. And that's why blockchains don't prove any information that isn't inherent to the blockchain. If there's a set of rules that you can prove by, like, you know, some set of cryptographic proofs, like a hash, like a series of transactions and all these things, well, then yes, you can verify that information if it was created within the parameters of the blockchain. But making a blockchain does not fix medical records. Like, anything with human input is as equally unreliable on a blockchain as it is off a blockchain. Like, it doesn't, that's not what it does. And in fact, it has no metric, or it has no consequence on that whatever. Like, I mean, imagine if it does tell time, so you can go back and see if someone lied, if you have new data and you can compare it to the old data, because again, it's a system of telling, of creating a decentralized chronology of events. But you know, if like Bernie Madoff or Enron or something like that is like posting their accounting and their budgeting and stuff, their revenue streams onto the blockchain, it doesn't fix the fact that they were lying about it. It doesn't fix the fact that they were covering up debt in, you know, shell corporations that were then turning around that they actually owned. So they were just pushing debt off of their balance sheet and looking like they're running this huge giant profit. Like, it doesn't solve that. It does nothing at all with information outside of it. All it can do is tell time and verify information against its own rules. It can verify Bitcoin because those Bitcoin were created within the rules. They don't exist anywhere else. It can do those things in relation to itself, and that's it. Those are the only things that it can verify. Outside of that, it's all just a shot in the dark. It's all just people writing stuff down with all the same errors and all the same trust issues and everything else that comes with just logging it or just checking it on Google. But there's another concept that is hit really well in this that I just think is so fascinating and counterintuitive at the same time, and it kind of hurts your brain to try to wrap your head around it. But I want to talk about it a little bit because it is something that is so difficult for the human mind to deal with. The example, this is of memorylessness, to have a memoryless process to go through. And he said the quote was the best example of memorylessness is a coin toss. If a coin comes up heads 10 times in a row, does it mean that the next coin toss is more likely to be tails? Our intuition says yes, but in reality, each toss has a 50-50 chance of either outcome, regardless of what happened immediately prior. End quote. So two amazing books on this that really hit this concept and are just so fun to explore are The Drunkard's Walk. This one I actually have on the Bitcoin Survivors book list. You can get on thecryptoeconomy.com. And then also Fooled by Randomness by Taleb. And both of these do such a good job of showing how human intuition makes it so difficult to understand this concept. And a good way to kind of grasp it is that the probability, because we know how rare it would be to get 11 heads in a row, the probability of doing that right now is 2 to the 11th power. So it's 1 out of 2,048 chance for that to actually happen, for 11 heads to turn up to be flipped in a row. So it seems like, it feels like, after we have tossed up heads 10 times in a row, that the next toss must be incredibly unlikely to be heads. But that wasn't the case. That's not the case. It was a very low probability before we flipped heads 10 times in a row. But after that, after we have already flipped a coin and gotten heads 10 times, the next one is still just 50-50. Because the past has no effect on the next coin toss. In fact, there's still a 1 in 2048 chance of flipping another 11 heads in a row. And to flip the next heads, it's still just 50-50. And this is part of what makes the problem universal, is that everyone can collectively work on this without communicating, because, well, they have to communicate if they find a solution, but if they don't find a solution, it doesn't matter that A, they didn't find a solution, and that B, they didn't communicate that they didn't find a solution or that they were doing anything at all, because their attempt at trying to find it is another person flipping heads. Every coin toss that doesn't come up the way it's supposed to come up still affects the outcome of how quickly we do flip the coin and come up with the right number of heads or whatever it is. It's funny, in establishing the fact that, you know, this is a universal problem, is that, you know, technically anybody anywhere in the universe could work on it. It's just hinted at about like time dilation and the fact that, you know, geographically distinct. Like if we were trying to use like a time stamp to organize all of this, that wouldn't work because of all the minute differences in just geographical areas. And the more incremental you get down in time, inevitably those time stamps are not going to line up, even if they're quote unquote synchronized. There's actually no physical way to be perfectly synchronized across space, because time is different across space. The speed of light is critical in that. And what's funny is that It's not mentioned in this article that, you know, it says that, like, we could have miners on Mars that help out and they don't need to know or even communicate with the Earth miners. And the problem would still be solved every 10 minutes. But then obviously a little, you know, inserts like, okay, well, they'll need to tell somebody on Earth that they solved it if they do. But that just makes me go back to the whole idea of the center of hash. Dhruv Bansal's excellent article from Unchained Capital digging into how you basically couldn't mine on Mars because of the amount of time it takes to send a solution to Earth, is that the essentially that decentralized clock to actually, you know, make it function, you'd need like 2 hour block times to get over that, the barrier of communication at the speed of light, because it was like 8 minutes, I think it was, from Mars to Earth, if I'm not mistaken. So essentially every single, like, probability wise, like, I guess 8 out of 10, it'd probably be roughly 80% of the blocks mined on Mars would be orphaned by blocks mined on Earth. And that's essentially if, you know, you have the exact same hash rate. And that's where you get the idea of the center of hash is, what's the weight of hash rate on Earth versus the weight of the hash rate on Mars. And therefore, within in the realm of just communicating the solution to each other, how close are you to the dominant hash rate? And that just is a really fun article to dig into. So if you haven't listened to that one, I did that in two parts, and it's called Bitcoin Astronomy, Bitcoin Astronomy by Dhruv Bansal. I will link to that one in the show notes. Let me write that down so I don't forget it. But he has a really fun thought experiment about how essentially new planets will require a new coin. They will require their own Bitcoin or their own Musk coin, I think is what he referred to it as. But let's say that the speed of light is not a problem, that we can communicate instantly between Mars and Earth or anywhere in the universe. If we could do that, then the principle stands that this is a universal problem, and it does not matter. It does not matter if there's a whole alien species that is basically contributing to the hash rate and trying to solve hashes, and we just have no idea if they can communicate that solution to us and just somehow insert it into the network. Well, then they are part of the hash rate, and they're helping to solve the problem, even if they never actually find a block. But as a clock, it is, quote, operated by the multi-exahash rate, which I think we're now at like 120-something exahashes, of an unknown number of collective participants spread across the planet, completely independent of one another, end quote. And one of the other fascinating things about this concept is that we measure the hash rate backwards. Like, the fact that any individual participant simply trying a hash, even if in secret, that it's contributing to the hash rate, well, we can do that in reverse. We can measure the hash rate by the statistical, by the probability of comparing the difficulty to the number of, like, how quickly we get blocks. So, like, as blocks come in every 10 minutes, since the difficulty is adjusted according to that, we can actually turn around and do the reverse. That even if we didn't know who any of the miners were, if blocks kept coming in, if the solution continued to be found every 10 minutes, we know we can make, over a period of time, a pretty accurate measurement of what the hash rate is. Because probabilistically, the more time that passes, the more accurate the probability, the more accurate the reality of finding blocks, the reality of finding solutions to this universal problem will match up with the probability of doing it. Quote, when one sees a hash that satisfies the difficulty, one knows it must have taken time. The method by which the delay is accomplished is work, but the hash is primarily interesting because it is a proof of time. This was a really cool, this was right here at the end, but I thought that was a really cool statement, just that what makes the work interesting is that it is a proof that it took time to do it. And the physics definition, like the equation of work, both in the physical sense and the thermodynamic sense, are a factor of time. Whether you talk about it in the context of force and acceleration, or you talk about it in the context of like joules. But ultimately, that element of it is what's being utilized, is the ultimate function that it's trying to get out of it. It's trying to go from work back to the time that's required to produce it, so that you can order those events based on the requirement of that in the equation of work. But this is where we get to those secondary side effects. And this is where I guess it's not really that I disagree. Actually, I kind of agree with the whole concluding paragraph, except for the fact that I think it's a little bit unrealistic, because the incentive structure is also a critical part of the security of it. Because it is, yes, it's about a decentralized way to tell time, a decentralized way to create a timestamp server that orders the events. But it's also a way to maintain a decentralized clock in the face of a potential adversary. How do you create an incentive structure where someone does not work against the clock, but instead works with the clock? And that's where the work, aside from just obtaining the tick of the clock, that's where the work itself is also a critical part of the function, that the economic incentive is to play with the clock rather than against the clock. Because it's not just coordinating people all towards one solution or all to operate or try to solve a collective problem. It is also to do so in the presence of an inevitable adversary. So the consequential immutability is not merely just an added feature in that way. It may not be the primary function, but I think it's why proof of work, well, maybe there isn't another one other than proof of work, but it has a dual benefit. It has a dual purpose, even though its primary, I would argue, is correct in saying that it's to tell time. But in that last, those last couple sentences is that, like, since it is about it being time consuming, but requires, you know, an enormous amount of energy, is that it means that the Bitcoin hash rate potentially could be excessive. And that if we could, the Bitcoin clock could operate reliably on even a fraction of the hash rate, which we've seen, you know, like Bitcoin has done that historically. But because the incentive structure is to, you know, alter the history of money, because the incentive to manipulate or corrupt the money is so unbelievably powerful, it's important for that incentive to be defended with an economic reward or an economic cost, since that is the reward of cheating it. But obviously we can use a hundredth of the hash rate and the Bitcoin clock still works, because Bitcoin has run on a hundredth of the hash rate. You know, it started from zero, essentially. But that if we could find a way to tell time, to have a proof of time that required less energy, maybe, you know, maybe that would be the solution to a $1 trillion problem. But I think it also has to face the reverse, that it proves time without the ability to shortcut that telling of time. So that, you know, technically you could get the same thing by having most people moving forward in time and any adversary having to work against it. But if there's no economic cost, then it wouldn't really hurt for them to try to go backwards. It would just be a factor of time. Like, they would just, it would just be how long it took them to do so. I don't know. It's kind of hard to separate them, because necessarily, like, time is a cost. And again, the only reason we know it takes time is because the work can't be cheated. So it seems like one of those things, kind of like a you know, a quantum computer sort of thing, is that like theoretically it's like, oh, you know, we could do this, but it may very well be in a situation, or it may turn out to be that the fact that a quantum computer is physical, like must be physically operated, is the nail in the coffin to the fact that you couldn't actually scale it to the same problem. Like, that's theoretically it still operates, like theoretically it still works, but the limitations of the error correction are a problem of physicality. So it works in theory, but might not ever really be able to build one that operates in a meaningful sense on the realm, or on the scale of, you know, 2 to the 256, like a public private key situation. I don't know. That's a whole other episode, but it kind of seems like work is critical to the function of time, especially when we're talking about in a digital sense, in information, in an informational sense, because information can just be freely edited. Like there is no cost to information, which is what makes it impossible to do anything. That's why proof of work is such a powerful tool in this context, is because it creates an information that does have a cost. But it's just a fascinating article, one that was definitely needed to be in audio for the show. So another shout out to Marty and Chris for that episode. I will link to that. Actually, don't let me forget about that. What was that? Episode 188, I think. 188 of Tales from the Crypt, if you want to hear them talking about this as well. And I'll remember to put in the links for those two books. So you can check out the rest of the Bitcoin Survivors book list. I've got so many great books up there. If you haven't read and or listened to them, they're must listens, must reads for anybody who really wants to wrap their head around kind of the history and some of these fascinating ideas that just enlighten so much about the Bitcoin system and randomness. And like the idea of probability is one of those things that I literally never found until Bitcoin. I've never dug into deeply, and some of those books have been the most fascinating for me. I love The Drunkard's Walk. Can't recommend it enough. You got to check it out. And of course, Fooled by Randomness was the other one by Taleb. And the last one will be Bitcoin Astronomy by Dhruv Bansal. So if you haven't dug into any of those and you want to, those links will be in the show notes on the anchor in your podcast description and or on bitcoinaudible.com. And of course, lastly, do not forget, if you want to support the show, you can always tip at thecryptoeconomy.com. Donations are always massively appreciated, and this show depends a lot on its patrons and the people who support the show. I absolutely would not do this without you guys. It's amazing, the number of people who help, who send me links about stuff to read, who are always helping out, like helping me find people to work with stuff, who are donating to the show. I mean, it's just awesome the number of people who have come out in support of this. So thank you to everyone who has. Thank you to everybody in the Telegram group, in our crypto economy crew, our Bitcoin audio knots. We got a great group over there. And if anybody wants to join, you can become a patron at patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy. And it only takes $1 a month will get you in the group. I just want to keep it to the people who are really dedicated to supporting the show. So thank you all. And of course, share this out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin space. And lastly, if you want to sponsor the show, hit me up on Twitter or via email at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com and let's talk. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan. Thank you so much for listening. We have got another great episode coming tomorrow, so don't forget to subscribe. And until then, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.